Okay, let's go ahead and get started. Go ahead and look at the cover of your notes, because everybody always ignores the cover, but we put a lot of time and energy into the cover. So let me just say a word about that. Let me officially welcome you to Leadership Skills for a Growing Church. This seminar is called Leadership Skills for a Growing Church. The subtitle, The Six Secret Skills Every Church Leader Can Develop. And I'll explain that subtitle as we go along. But let me just explain to those who are listening to this recording or this download or CD where we are and what's going on. We're in Manhattan today. It's actually a very pleasant day in Manhattan for a winter day. And we're beginning to thaw out here. And in the room, I wish everybody listening could see the faces of the room. There's just tremendous amount of leadership capacity in the room, of leaders in different levels and churches. There's tremendous diversity in the room, and just a lot of excitement today. And so I'm excited to present this to you, and I'm glad that you're here for this presentation. And I want to just jump in on leadership for a second and want to tell you about the seminar. I guess the first thing I should tell you about the seminar is many of you know me and have listened to my training events on church systems. And that's sort of the bread and butter of where I spend most of my thinking in church leadership and church growth is about church systems. And there is a church system called leadership, and we'll be rolling that out sometime in the near future. This is not that seminar. This is not the church system. And so today we're not going to talk so much about like how to build leaders in your church or talk about how to develop systems for leadership development, although some of what we say will be applicable in that area. And so I'm not trying to give you a full system like we're doing this afternoon in the assimilation seminars or any of the others. And I usually have these creative names for systems simply called seminars. So, you know, we have assimilation, evangelism, and worship planning, and I don't know what all we have now, stewardship, small groups, but there will be a leadership system that comes out in the next couple of years. But this instead is a leadership skills seminar, and it's really designed for people who are in church leadership. It's a sharpening the saw kind of seminar where we're going to look at six very specific skills that we all maybe can develop and do better. And this seminar has really been forming in my mind for quite a long time. I have been a student of leadership since I was young. I don't really know why. I've just always had this fascination with leadership. I had the good fortune, even as like a early teenager, to discover something I was good at. And I discovered that I was really good at logic and really good at strategy, and that played out in the early 1980s with learning how to use the early computers and PC and things like that. And I started a computer programming business when I was 13. That was really just a car fund at the time is what that was about. But I knew I needed to make money. I tried mowing lawns, and this was a whole lot easier. And so I thought, well, I'll do this, and I sold a couple of programs, and I liked it. Then by the time I was 16, I had a pretty good business going, and that sort of forced me to figure out some things. Like some older folks in the community where I was growing up, they helped me out. They gave me leadership books, and I remember one guy gave me an audio recording. It was a cassette tape, not 8-track. I'm not that old. But it was a cassette tape of Zig Ziglar talking about goals. And he talked about how you have to set goals and you need to achieve goals. And I must have listened to that audio cassette just, you know, thousands of times. I mean, every time I was in the car, I had that on. And then he gave me another one called The Power of Positive Thinking by a guy who was a pastor here in New York City, by Norman Vincent Peale. And those two just really got me on this track of wanting to read about attitude, read about leadership skills, learn how to develop team, and then being forced into that by leading this business and trying to figure out how to lead other programmers and negotiate deals with people who were, you know, 10, 20 years older than me, sort of put me in the leadership arena. And then around age 16, right around age 17, I was selected as one of the top entrepreneurs in the nation. And I got to meet the president. I got to go to Disney World, you know, do all that kind of cool stuff. And because I was the youngest of this list, they put me on a speaking circuit. And I would travel around and I would deliver little lectures. And some of you have heard me say this before. They were silly little lectures that I would give. It was usually something like, you know, I started a small business in America. You can start one too and do well. God bless Ronald Reagan. And that was the big, that was like the speech, you know. And then they would get me out of the way, and the real speakers would come in, you know. But, you know, that's sort of what I did. But I got to hang around with some of these other big-name speakers. I actually got to meet Zig Ziglar. I got to meet a guy who was an envelope salesman named Harvey McKay. He's written a number of great leadership, just practical books about how to manage businesses with great titles like Beware the Naked Man Who Offers You His Shirt. You know, that's just a great title. Dig Your Well Before You're Thirsty. His book that sort of made him famous was How to Swim with the Sharks Without Being Eaten Alive. And so even though I was young and arrogant and not even a Christian yet, I knew that I had some opportunities here. And so I would read these books of the people I was traveling with and try to get to know them and be around them. And then I went off to college, and my college had a new leadership library. And I love this because you could go and check out all these videos, and it was VCR tapes, and you could check out all of these audio books. And I just lived there and just loved that while I was in college. And it was around that time that I came to Christ. And I came to Christ by reading a book by Billy Graham, and that not only changed my soul and my eternal destination, but over the next few months it also sort of changed my career. And so I changed my little speech. You know, I changed my speech from, I started a small business, you can too, I did really well, to now I found something that you need to find too, and his name is Jesus. And that sort of caused my speaking engagements to dry up. They didn't want to put me on these business shows anymore. You know, they didn't want me to do that. But a number of churches sort of took me under their wing, and they're like, oh, you're an evangelist. So I spent the next 5 or 6 years giving a similar type speeches in churches, talking to young Christian leaders, and that's how I got involved in New York, and it's a long story from there. But I just want you to know, I've been trying to read and study everything I can because I am not a natural leader. I had a speech impediment as a kid, so I had to work through that. I was not around a bunch of leaders. My dad was a small business owner. I think he did well. But, you know, he certainly wasn't someone who was leading people. He worked. He got paid. If he didn't work, he didn't get paid. And so, you know, I've had to figure this out. And then in ministry, for some reason, I've also been thrust around some people who have taught me leadership and have been able to hang out with some of the top Christian leaders for the last 5 or 6 years in a really close proximity. And so I've been trying to learn all of this. In 1995, I started writing about what I was learning in leadership. And I created a website called Smart Leadership. It's still there. I gave you some articles in your appendix from that website. I wrote probably about 30 articles. I actually wrote about 50, but about 20 of them were just really bad. And so I deleted those, and I've kept 30 on this little website. And now for like 12 years, those articles have been there, and I revise them from time to time. I add new ones from time to time. But it's been amazing how those articles have made it out there. And some of my articles have been studied in business schools. Some have been reprinted in major magazine. Others have, the bread and butter is little trade journal magazines or nonprofit organizations who need filler for their newsletter or whatever. And I've just kept it out there. It costs me about $50 a month. I don't do a whole lot with it. But it's just again, part of that leadership journey of trying to communicate what this thing is called leadership. And I've been fascinated by that. Matter of fact, my two fascinations for the last 10 years of my life have been in the area of church growth and leadership. And I'm fascinated by how quickly a church can grow. And there's a number of you in this room who have been in coaching networks with me, or you're in coaching networks with me now, where we talk about church growth and we talk about leading our churches to grow and trying to expand God's kingdom as quickly as possible, reach as many unchurched people as we can. And I'm just fascinated by that. And then at the same time, this other passion of mine that's coming together called leadership. And what I've learned about leadership and church growth is they really do go together. And there is a correlation between leadership and between church growth. And that's why this seminar is called Leadership Skills Every Church Leader Can Develop. Because I've learned that sometimes churches don't grow because leaders don't grow. And sometimes churches are held back in their potential because a leader is lacking a few key skills in their toolbox. And that's what I want to talk about in this. And I call them the 6 secret skills, just to entice you. And I'm trying to, you know, get you to awake on that. But if you turn over to page 2 in your notes, I want to explain why I called them secret skills. I've called these the secret skills because I don't plan to teach on a comprehensive seminar on leadership today. I mean, if we did that, we'd need, a week, maybe 2 weeks or whatever, if we're going to teach everything about leadership. Like, you'll notice in the notes as we get into them, there's nothing in here about vision. Now, I think vision is extremely important. There's a skill that helps produce vision that we're going to talk about, but I'm not going to talk to you necessarily about vision, although I think that's an extremely important element of leadership. There's a leader creates systems. I call it in a leadership book that I'm working on, creating pathways. and you create systems on which people can run. And I've created a number of church systems that maybe hopefully some of you have benefited from with assimilation and small groups and all that. But I'm not talking a lot today about systems, although I'm going to talk about a skill that might help you think more systematically or may give you the time to view church as systems. But that's not in here, even though I think that's a very important. So a lot of the common stuff on leadership that you may have read about or been familiar with is not here. Instead, what I want to do is really try to highlight what I'm calling these six secret skills. Because as I've had an opportunity to rub shoulders with some top leaders, I've noticed that every once in a while they'll do something that I've seen other top leaders do, but nobody talks about it very much. So I want to kind of bring to light maybe some of these hidden skills and try to put some application behind some of these key leadership principles. And I hope that makes sense. And I should tell you, I've been very influenced by Rick Warren, had the opportunity to serve with him for a number of years at Saddleback. But prior to that, just read everything he wrote and went to his conferences and all that. Been very influenced by him. My primary mentor in ministry, just had breakfast with him yesterday, is Steve Stroop. He's the pastor of Lake Point Church. I mean, they've taught me, you know, ministry leadership. And so they've influenced me on this. I've been listening to and reading John Maxwell since I was a teenager, you know, through his CDs and through his tapes. So you're probably going to hear some of that in here. I've tried to memorize on a number of occasions The Effective Executive by Peter Drucker. So you're going to hear that in here and some of his readings. So, you know, there's nothing new in this subject. So some of this may be familiar. Some of it may be new, but I hope it challenges you. But of course, the ultimate source for any of us in this room about leadership is the Scripture. And Romans 12:8 in the New Living Translation talks about taking the responsibility of leadership seriously. So let's read this verse out loud with great enthusiasm, okay? Here we go, out loud together. Romans 12:8. Are you ready? Here we go. If God has given you leadership ability, take the responsibility seriously. Good job. Circle the word seriously. Take it seriously. You're doing that today. Just by being here today, you're taking leadership seriously. Another translation that I grew up memorizing of Romans 12:8 was if you are placed in leadership, then lead with all diligence. That was how that phrase seriously was translated. Lead with all diligence. And you're doing that today by being here. But, you know, when it comes to church leadership, you don't want to be casual about leadership. Casual church leadership leads to casualties. And what you and I are involved in when we're talking about eternal things, when we're talking about the big things of church and kingdom and eternity and heaven and all of that, it's too important to be casual. Spiritual growth is too important to be casual. Eternity is too important to be casual. Significance and all of these things that we handle so regularly but yet are so important are too important to be handled casually. So we are going to explore this over the next 3 hours. And I want to give you a few key seminar assumptions. I've already hit on these. They're printed for you in your notes. Seminar assumption number one is that you are interested in growing as a leader. You're showing that by being here. You have an interest in that. Something is sparked in you. So probably because God has given you leadership ability. Next, church leadership, I believe, is the highest level of leadership. And I've been involved in leading small businesses as well as helping out in corporations. Very large corporations, like for a number of years, I worked with the Postal Service as a programmer and a consultant with them. I also did with an energy company, a power company. One time I was able to work with some of their vice presidents. And compared to those things and compared to all of that, church leadership is far more intensive. We have to try to influence people to do things versus coerce them to do things, you know. Intimidation rarely works in the church. So it's a very intensive leadership process that we're involved in. And then I believe, number three, that you're active in leadership development already. And that's what I said. I'm hoping you've already read some and studied some, that perhaps this is not your first introduction to leadership. And even if it is, I hope to spur you to read more, because this is just a specific area of leadership. So let me give you three principles to define leadership, just to open that file in your mind and to get you to think about leadership. And then I'm going to give you skill number one. Principle number one, you probably heard this phrase, leadership is influence. Leadership is influence. Sometimes leadership is intimidation, you know, but generally leadership is influence. It's getting people to do things that you want them to do or that they need to do without might or coercion on that. I think that's leadership at its purest form. John Maxwell has popularized this phrase that leadership is influence, nothing more, nothing less. If you've ever heard him speak, you probably hear that in your mind with his unique voice. But the first person I encountered saying this was Oswald Sanders in his classic book called Spiritual Leadership, which is not in your notes and not one of the books I mentioned, but is one of those books I try to read every couple of years. It's a small little book. And he was a great Christian leader of the last century or so. And he talked about leadership as influence. And so how do we influence people? How do we move people and get them to do things that are going to honor God? Next, just trying to get you to think on leadership a moment. Leadership determines outcome. Leadership determines outcome. Whatever the result, whatever is accomplished, you can always trace that back to leadership. Something happens because someone took action, and leadership is influence in action. So there's an outcome. There's a direct correlation between the outcomes that are produced and the leadership that's given. A poor outcome often is preceded by poor leadership. A good outcome is usually preceded by good leadership. Now, it's not as simple as that. It may start out poor, and then you can change it to good and still make it work, you know. So it's not like it's a set consequence, because you can change it, it's in flux. But I want you to understand that leadership determines outcome. And while there are some things in the Christian world you can't explain other than the supernatural blessing of God, there are other things that can be directly tied back to leadership and effective leadership, and we're going to look at some of that. And then number three, just a very simple thing here, leadership requires followers. Leadership requires followers. I first encountered that in a book I read called The 9 Natural Laws of Leadership. Again, I didn't put that in your notes. But it does remind me of my favorite leadership proverb, which says, if you say you are leading but no one is following, you're merely taking a walk. And so, if someone says, I'm a leader, I'm like, great, show me your followers. You know, who's following you? And over the lifetime of a leader, as we build churches and grow churches under the power of the Holy Spirit, God blesses us with followers and then more followers, and we organize those followers and we have systems for how to do that. So that's some principles that define where I'm going. So you know my assumptions, you know some of my definition. If you have already had a chance, you may have written down a couple of goals for this seminar of what you hope to get out of today. That may guide you with some questions you want to ask or maybe even something you want us to discuss that's not quite as evident on that. So let's turn over and let's talk about leadership skill number one, the first secret skill. As we get ready to look at this, I live my life sort of by a principle called learn and return. I was the first person to coin that phrase. Others have used it. But that is, if you learn something, you should return that back to the kingdom. Because we're not in competition in here. We all work for the same organization. We all have the same CEO, you know. And so if I learn something at my church that's going to help you, I should return that back to you. If you learn something in your place that helps me, I should return that back. You should return that back to the kingdom, because this learning, this rising tide sort of raises all the ships. And so this is sort of a way for me to return some of the secrets that I've learned along the way from other leaders, some of the things that I've learned here at The Journey, which has been my most recent leadership intensive class that I've been involved in. And so I want to give you these secret skills. So here's number one. Secret skill number one, all leaders of growing churches are lifelong learners. Lifelong learners. And that's where we're going to start. The myth in the United States is that you learn when you're young, you know. And it's really interesting that society will spend the first 12 years forcing us to learn and then leave the next 60 years up to us. And most of us in this room have gone beyond that. We've spent at least 12 years in formal education and then probably an additional 4 years in college, maybe an additional master's degree or doctorate degree or some kind of formalized study. But it's really interesting that as we get older, society puts less and less pressure on us to learn. Yet that's exactly when we need to learn. I mean, how hard is it to lead as a fifth grader? You know, you just go to class, keep your locker clean. I mean, that's pretty simple, you know. But when you get older, that's when you start facing challenges. And when you get out in the real world, and the moment you enter the real world is the moment when the formal education of society stops. So what I've noticed about leaders who are really making a difference is they are lifelong learners. And it says in your notes, all leaders are learners. Now, not all learners are leaders. You can be an academic. You can be a learner. You can be in that field of study without leading. And sometimes that's true. Some of the most educated people are some of the least influential. You know, that's just the way it is. But leaders are learners. And leaders learn in two different ways. They either learn by doing. They learn by doing. You just, you know, it's called experience. I heard a little joke about that last night in a book I was reading. It was a silly story about three animals that went out to hunt deer. I don't know. That's just the way the story set up. So there was a bear, a fox, and a rabbit, and they went all out to hunt a deer. And they each shot one deer apiece on this hunting trip. And when they got back to the cabin, the bear said, how do you think we should divide up today's spoils? And the little rabbit said, well, I think we should each get one deer apiece. So the bear reached over and ate the rabbit. And then the bear turned to the fox and he said, how do you think we should divide it up? And the fox said, I think you should have all the deers. And he said, you're so wise. Where did you learn that? He said, I learned it from the rabbit. You know, so you can learn by doing, you know. But, you know, most of us don't have enough time to do everything so that we can learn what we need to do. So you have to not only learn by doing, but you have to also learn from others. And you have to go looking for it. You know, you have to go seeking this knowledge from others. That's why Proverbs 16:16 says, how much better to get wisdom than gold and understanding than silver? And Jesus talked about that. You know, you have to go ask for it. You have to seek if you want to find. Good ideas rarely sneak up on you. So you've got to go looking for those ideas. You've got to go searching for those ideas. Unfortunately, a lot of people have put a lot of ideas out there, and they're in formats like we're doing today or books or whatever. A quote that drives me in this area is from Oliver Wendell Holmes. He says, one's mind, once stretched by a new idea, never regains its original dimensions. So if you want your mind to grow, you have to seek new ideas. And so I want to challenge you in this first point to be a collector of good ideas, to be a collector of wisdom, to be a collector of understanding. It's not only better than gold, it's the path to gold, if you want to do a real honest application of Proverbs 16:16. I mean, the people who have the most influence usually know the most. It's not always the case, but most of the time that's the case. And so high-performing leaders that I've observed have this passion, have this radical desire for learning. And for most of them, I've discovered this is not natural. You know, I was talking about this with some of our church leaders the other day, and I was talking about studying the Bible and studying theology and all of that. And I said, look, this is not natural for me to get into commentaries or to get into theology books or to, you know, go to seminars. That's not natural for me. It's natural for me to sit home, watch TV, and eat nachos. I mean, that's what's natural, you know, for me. So it's a discipline, you know, and it's impossible to be a disciple without discipline. And so leadership requires discipline as well. And so you have to discipline yourself to do that. No one grows by accident. You know, there's a plan. There's a process. And for those of us in this room who might say, you know, we just don't have natural leadership abilities. And I would say that about myself. I'm not a natural leader, just like I'm not a natural speaker. I have to work at it, you know, and push myself to speak and to talk. I'm not a natural leader. And so I put in your notes, it's possible to make up in learning what you lack in intuition. If you don't like the word intuition, you can use the word instinct. And this kind of reminds me of that old question about, you know, are leaders born or made? You know, well, that's sort of a silly question. If you're alive, you were born, you know. So I don't know if leaders are, you know, of course all leaders are born, you know. Anybody breathing is born. But I really do think it's made. And you may have certain lids, you may have certain things that might hold you back from leading at some of the top levels because of how you were born. But I really don't even think that's true most of the time. I think you can learn it. And I think you can go after it. And I really do think you can make up in learning what you lack in intuition or instinct. So here's the question for us on this first skill. What is my current personal development plan? What is my current personal development plan? And for those of you who have been in coaching networks with me, you know, I'm big on this. I'm pushing you on this. Like, what are the books you're going to read? Another way to say that opening quote I gave you is all leaders are readers. There is still something, even in our day, with all the extraordinary ways we have to learn about a book and about the interaction between the book and a reader. And, you know, most authors will put a lifetime of learning, you know, in a small amount of paper and sell it for 10 or 20 bucks, you know. And people say, well, you know, I can't afford that. Well, you can't afford not to, you know. I mean, you know, 10 bucks for a book, that's, you know, just a,
skip a couple of Cokes a day, and you can pay for that, you know. I mean, that's eating lunch at home once a week or whatever. So, you know, you have to go after this. You have to have a plan. And then conferences added to that are seminars like the one we're doing today. Sometimes, you know, the most current information is not in books yet, so you have to go to the conferences. Or sometimes you need to take a couple of days or a half a day like this and go somewhere and sit under someone, because it's not just the communication from the presenter. It's something that happens in the room, you know. And I tell people all the time when they come to seminars with me, I hope today you hear from me. I hope you hear from each other, but I also hope you hear from God. And so as you get alone and you get away, you know, in a setting like this, it sometimes it will make you more alert to new ideas. And the Bible says a wise person is always open to new ideas. In fact, they look for them, is what the proverb writer says. I heard Rick Warren say one time that seminary will teach you to grow a church to 100. If you want to grow beyond that, you have to go to seminars. And that's the power of conferences and seminars like this. Then, of course, there's audio recording. You know, when your hands are tied up but your mind is open, you can have something playing. You can have audio recordings going. And, man, you know, there's so many tools for this today. Audible.com and downloads and MP3 players and iPods, you know, that you can just have this going. And your subconscious mind will just pick up on that, you know. And you can turn off the disc jockey or turn off the radio station and just, you know, have this whole thing going and read so many books along the way. And then something that God's blessed in more recent time is coaching opportunities. This was always out there in the business world, but it's something now that's coming to the Christian world of just getting around with another 8 to 12 people who are in the same boat as you and letting iron really sharpen iron through a systematic coaching process. And that's something I've enjoyed over the last couple of years being a part of. And then personal and spiritual accountability. You know, so these things all go into your personal development plan. And, you know, for those of us here in the live recording, we're not that far into the new year. So it's, you know, it's a good time. You know, you've already given up on your New Year's resolutions. So now you can put together your personal development plan. But here's a big point for today. This one I hope will haunt you when you leave today. Growing churches are led by growing leaders. Growing churches are led by growing leaders. Show me a growing church and I'll show you a growing leader. So what's your plan? So here's a few thoughts for you on what you should constantly be learning. Growing church leaders are constantly learning theology. I put Bible study into theology. I mean, our fundamental text for theology is the Scripture, but sometimes we have to have help, you know, and we have to read books on theology, or we have to go to courses on theology. So theology is very important. Theology helps us understand the wisdom of the ages, helps us apply the Bible and understand God. And then philosophy. We need to know a little bit of philosophy. Because there's the way that the world works that people, whether they're Christian or not, have discovered. And so it helps to understand philosophy. Even if it's philosophy you don't agree with, it's philosophy that other people have bought into that you're going to be interacting with. And every person in your church has a philosophy of life. And part of our goal is to take the philosophy of life that they've bought into and to convert them in the power of the Holy Spirit to the philosophy of life as presented in the Scripture. And so you've got to know a little bit. You don't have to become a philosophy, you know, major or a philosophy, you know, academic type person, a professor. But you do want to have, you know, be a little bit of a philosophy teacher on this. And then finally, best practices. Best practices. You know, a lot of people have figured out a lot of things in our day. You know, business books contain best practices. And I think the church can learn from this. I don't think it's strange to say that the church can learn from the business world, you know, because we do a lot of similar things that the business world does. Managing teams, the business world knows how to do that. Structuring organizations for efficiency, the business world knows how to do that. And we can take those things that are out there, this best practice of the day, and we can bring those into the church and use those to glorify God. And I don't think that's wrong. I think, why wouldn't we do that? You know, Jesus said one time we should be as wise as serpents and harmless as doves, I believe is the quote. You know, we're really good at that harmless thing, but we're not always good at that wise, or shrewdness is the other word. You know, and sometimes Jesus said that. He said sometimes the people of the world are more shrewd than the people of God. And so we have to learn best practices. And I know most of you, you know, just by being here and who would listen to this type of recording, you understand that. You're involved in that. So how are you doing as a growing leader? How are you doing as a lifelong learner? If you want your church to grow more, you first got to become more. And so you've got to grow on this. I put a few recommended resources at the bottom of page 3 for you, a book that I've greatly enjoyed recently, Leading at a Higher Level by Ken Blanchard. He probably wouldn't agree with this, but I think you could throw out every other Ken Blanchard book and just buy this one, because it's really a systematic presentation of his entire leadership philosophy that he's put out in 50 of those little books. Now it's contained in one big book. And so it save a lot of room on your shelf, if nothing else, you know, if you do that. Plus, you don't have to suffer through some of those crazy parable things that are out there, you know. There's more books on page 10 if you're interested in my top 10 list of leadership books. And then I have an audio CD that'll be out by the time anyone listening to this, called Developing a One-Year Personal Growth Plan. Not out yet for those of you here, but it is coming out shortly. Okay, secret skill number one. Everybody with me? All right. Thanks, Rick, for saying that on the front row. Nothing else, man. We're here. Terry, you're with me too, right? So Rick and Terry, we're together. How about there? Everybody else good? All right, good. Let's go to leadership skill number two. Leadership skill number two, all leaders of growing churches lead teams. All leaders of growing churches lead teams. This one at first shot may not be quite as apparent as the first one. So let me try to explain. Leaders have followers. We talked about that in the introduction. Leaders have followers. And so if you have followers, that's called a team of people. And so how are you going to lead that team? And sometimes leaders leave capacity in the conference table or on the conference table. And by that I mean, you're sitting around a conference table, you've got a lot of capacity with the people around there, but you never maximize that capacity. You never mobilize the people who are following you to achieve big things for God. And we've all felt this tension, right? We look at that person and we say, you know, here's someone. I'll just pick on Peter since he's sitting right here, you know. Here's Peter, and he's a high-capacity guy, and he's on this team, and he's at the meetings, and he's making it. He wants to commit it. But I have somehow yet not figured out how to release that skill to affect this team. And then I see him go back out to his job where he serves as, you know, the vice president of some organization down on Wall Street. And he's wheeling and dealing and changing, you know, the face of economy. And yet I can't figure out how to get him to do that in my church. And it's because the business world sometimes has figured out teams. They figured out how to mobilize people. And they figured out how to take groups of people and help them accomplish extraordinary things. Does that make sense? So let me give you a leadership progression. And this is kind of how it starts as you start to lead and you begin to lead followers. Number one, I lead myself. That's where it all starts. You know, sometimes people don't follow us because they don't trust us. And they're like, you know, that person just doesn't elicit confidence in me because they don't have self-leadership. It's apparent that they weren't prepared for the meeting. It's apparent that they don't have a clear vision about where we're going. It's apparent that they just don't have the innate personal skills. Because people want to follow a winner. They want to follow someone who knows where they're going. They want to follow someone who's an achiever. Not perfection. People will give you a break. People will cut you slack. You know, nobody's perfect or whatever. But they want to see that you've led yourself. And so it starts with team leadership. It starts with leading myself, rather. And then once I lead myself, the next progression is I lead my team. I lead my team. Now, I like equations. I like little pithy ways of adding things up and looking at life. So you lead myself. You put, that's just one, you know. That's one person. When you lead yourself, you get about what you can do. Now, the good news is we can all do more than we're doing right now. We all have room to grow. We all can learn. We all can become, you know, more than we are now. But we have a limit. That is how much we can do. And then you begin to lead teams. And then it's you plus your team. And that's good. You get a lot more done, you know, because it's you plus the size of your team. But then there's even a greater progression of leadership, which is I lead leaders of teams. I lead leaders of teams. And so now you're leading leaders of teams. And this is really where you get into something like an equation that might be something like, 1 plus x to the power of x. And now we're really talking about something getting done. Now we're talking about serious synergy. We're talking about serious replication, reproduction, and achievement. And I know some of you are like, what in the heck does that equation mean? You know, it's okay. If you're not an equation person, you know, that's fine. I have more stories about bears and rabbits later. You know, maybe it's just me. Maybe I just view the world like that. But do you see how at each level you've gone from what you can do by yourself to what you can do with a few others to now what you can exponentially do through the power of team? And really, this is how the early church spread. I just recently reread The Acts of the Holy Spirit by Peter Wagner. And nobody from the Vineyard was even forcing me to do it. I just chose to do it, you know. I was teaching a class in our church on Acts, so sort of why I did it. But, you know, it just reminded me of this rapid, you know, expansion of the church. You know, it starts out with, you know, one leader. Just take the Apostle Paul, you know, and God converts him or whatever. And then he spends his time learning to develop himself, and he's being mentored, and he's being coached, and he's doing all that. Then it's he and you know, Mark not getting along, or, you know, he and Barnabas not getting along. Then it's a team, you know. And then over time, it's this rapid multiplication of where he's leading teams, and he's checking in on the team in Corinth, and he's checking in the team at Ephesus, and he's checking in, you know, with all this. And it's just this rapid multiplication. This is the process, and this is sort of how God set it up. There's all kinds of verses in the Bible about teams. Ecclesiastes 4:12 was one that came to mind here. Let's read this verse out loud together. A person standing alone can be attacked and defeated, but two can stand back to back and conquer. Three are even better, for a triple braided cord is not easily broken. So just take that from two people, make it now two teams, you know. One team standing alone can be attacked and defeated. Now it's harder than one person. It's harder to defeat a team than it is a person. But then now make it two teams. And then two teams are good, but then three teams are even better. And really, if you think about it, everything that you do in church is leading teams. And I want to change your perspective on that, to say everything I do is about leading teams. Now, some are volunteer teams. Some teams only have one member on them right now, but it's a team, you know. And you start putting blanks on a page. Is what I call that. You've got a team of one. You just start, you know, leaving blanks for the other two or three team members that you're expecting God to send you. And I find as you open up spots, as you open up places on a team, God will fill that vacuum. And so it's this constant thing. Wayne Cordero, in his excellent book, Doing Church as a Team, talks about that. I put it at the bottom. He talks about take every area of your church and divide it into four different parts. And then even if you just have one leader now, try to find three other leaders to help that person by dividing that area into quads. That takes one person, makes them into a team. Leighton Ford, in a book I recommend on page 10, in Transforming Leadership, just does an incredible job by looking at how Jesus led teams. And it's almost a spiritual theology of leadership, that book. But think about the power of that. Henry Ford, who accomplished a few things in the business world, although his namesake organization is suffering a bit in our day, he said, coming together is a beginning, so bring the team together. Keeping together is progress, and pretty difficult if you've ever done it. And then working together is success. Working together is success. So here's my little saying, and this is what I keep saying to myself over and over. I am an introvert. I really am. I would just soon do it myself. You know, that's my nature. A lot of you are like that, you know. If it's going to be done right, I've got to do it myself, you know. And that creates a lot of problems. It creates a lot of problems for skill number 7 that we're going to look at too, because you wear yourself out as part of that. But I just say to myself over and over this little phrase, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing as a team. If it's worth doing, it's worth doing as a team. And so maybe I'm actually hindering someone else from becoming all that God created them to be by not giving them the opportunity to be on my team. And so I've had to put theological legs underneath this. And that is, if I'm going to do it alone, when there's two or three other people who can help me, I'm actually robbing them from significance. And part of their spiritual growth, part of their being built up in the body of Christ could be that they need to do this with me. And that's why I can't allow anybody to do anything alone. Because if you're doing it alone, you're cheating the rest of our church from the opportunity to do it with you. You see how that works? Rick Warren, in his book, The Purpose-Driven Church, which a lot of people still don't know about, because life has been so big, he has a whole chapter on ministry. And, you know, part of God's plan for growing people is that they have an active place of ministry. And sometimes it's just something simple, like serving as an usher or a greeter, like we're going to see in the afternoon seminar. But that raises up people. So here's a key application point for you. Never do anything alone. Never do anything alone. A-L-O-N-E. We used to have a projector in this room. I'm not a huge fan of PowerPoint, but we did used to have a projector in this room. Then we started a video campus out in Jersey, and they stole our projector. So it's being used for the kingdom, so I have to do it old-fashioned here. There's an old saying by Andy Grove, the founder of Intel, that says, none of us is as smart as all of us. And, you know, when you're doing something alone, you're more likely to make mistakes. It's a lot more boring, you know, when you're by yourself. I know all my jokes, you know, and they're not even that good. So, you know, what are you doing that you're doing alone? And some of you are modeling this very well today, you know, just by bringing people here. That's why when I email you on your reservation for this, I'm like, bring somebody with you. You know, the travel time and the learning time and all, that's going to build teams in your church. It's going to build synergy in your church. So let me give you a short course on team management and development. Just a little simple thing here. You've got someone, you're wanting to bring them on your team. So here's how it starts. It starts with, I do and you watch. I do and you watch. Hey, come with me as I do this. You know, you want to raise up some lay people in your church to help you out with pastoral care. Say, come with me. Let's go to the hospital together today. And they go and, you know, they see all the cords coming out of somebody's face or mouth and they go puke. That's a good sign that they need to not watch anymore. You know, it just works that way. But if they have compassion and they pray and they really care about people, and, hey, maybe I've got somebody here. So I do, you watch. And then we do what? Together. We do together. Now, I'll lead the prayer in this hospital room. And when we go to the next one, I want you to say hello, and you lead the prayer. And so now we're doing it together, you know, and we're getting more accomplished, and everybody's going to have more energy when it's all over. And then you do, and I wrong. Applaud. I applaud. I tricked you. You see, you got to stay on your toes. Because, see, good leadership is not just watching. Good leadership is encouraging. You're doing a good job. I'm with you. I'm applauding you. And so what I'm challenging you to do is to become a master at team leadership. You know, most of us in this room do not know how to lead teams very well. And there's an art to leading teams. And there's a science to leading teams. And fortunately for us, a great Christian leader who leads a tremendous training organization for business leaders has put the science of team leadership down in like a 1995 book. And it's readily available. And the book is called The Performance Factor. The Performance Factor. It's down in the bottom of your notes. It's by Pat McMillan. And Pat McMillan is the head of Team Resources in Atlanta, Georgia, and he trains business leaders all around the world on how to manage teams. And so when he decided to put this book together, he actually published it through a Christian publishing house in Nashville called Broadman Holdman. And he wanted to do it through that so that the Christian world would have it, so that they would pay attention to it. And it is just incredible. Whenever I'm about to start a new team or I need to form a team or I've got a problem with the team, I go pull that out. And he's got this thing he calls a team wheel, W-H-E-E-L, like a team development wheel that is just incredible. And almost every problem I've ever had or every issue is because I violated one of those scientific points, so to speak, around that team wheel. So when I raise up a new team leader, I have them read it. Not an easy read. It's sort of a fun read, but it's not an easy read. And we have to work on team leadership skills. And I'm not the best at it. I struggle with it, and maybe you do too. But a lot of pastors stall out in this leadership progression somewhere between leading myself and leading my team. And then an even higher percentage of pastors stall out between leading my team and becoming a leader of team leaders. Because then you have to not only know how to do the team, but you have to know how to manage the team structure. So work on that. And here's my kingdom challenge. If your dream for your church can be accomplished by you alone, then your dream is too small. And I even add, rather emphatically, and your God is too small. You see, God's dream is far bigger than your dream. And God has more for your church than is being achieved now. You may be having some good things. You know, you may be on the highest growth rate that you've ever had. But I'm telling you, God wants all lost people to be found. God wants everybody to be brought into his family, and God wants all of them to be built to maturity. And so we're part of this, you know. So don't buy into the small thinking. And part of the plan to get you there is learning how to lead teams. In your appendix, I have an article called Inviting Others to Join You. It's one of the most popular articles that I've ever written. It's in Appendix D. You can take a look at that. And I give you also a systematic process for getting someone on the team. Because sometimes we don't know how to ask and invite people to join us. And then Pat McMillan and Wayne Cordero's book will pick up from there on how to lead teams. Everybody with me? Everybody learning something so far? Okay. Let's go to number three. And then we're going to try to take a break here at the midway here in the hour. Secret skill number trace. Is that what it is? Trace? Number three? Three? Anybody else know a word for number three in a different language? Trois? What? French. I'll have blue cheese with my. No, I'm just kidding. No, that's good. I don't know. You know what they say? Someone who knows three languages, right? They call that trilingual. Somebody who knows two languages, they call it bilingual. You know what they call somebody who only knows one? American. Yeah, exactly. See, that's what you tell your translator when you're on your mission trip, right? You know. And I barely know American. I'm butchering the language up here. But, you know, communication's a challenge. So that's not the point. Actually, this one's going to surprise you. The first two, you may have sort of thought, well, yeah, okay, I got it. This one and maybe number five and six are going to, I think, surprise you a little bit. And secret skill number three, all leaders of growing churches anticipate the future. Anticipate the future. Now, we could do a seminar on all of these. That's the joke every seminar leader says, right? We could spend any point and do a whole day on all of that. Probably not. I don't have enough content for some of these points. You know, I'm giving you all I got in 10 minutes, you know. But this one we really could. We really could spend a lot longer on this one. And there's even the phrasing here has been one I've tried to choose very carefully. But anticipation almost implies an expectation. I know you guys don't want to do it, but there's seats on the front row up here. So let's welcome these guys as they come in from Maryland and down the way. So come on around. There's a seat here, a seat on the second row, plenty of seats here on the front row. Vic, you're in the coaching network, so you can take a front row seat. And then you brought these other good-looking guys with you, and they'll brighten up the front room here as well. The word anticipation carries with it sort of a hopefulness, right? Because, you know, what's the opposite of anticipation? Dread is the opposite, you know, of anticipation. And so, you know, if we're looking forward to a trip or a vacation, we're anticipating it. If we're not looking forward to it, you know, we're dreading it. So I even chose this word fairly carefully because leaders have a hopeful view about the future. But that's not really where I wanted to go in this. I just wanted to point that out as a free little side bonus to you. But they have a hopeful view about the future, but they do more than that. They just don't hope it's well. They try to create ways to ensure that it goes well. And let's look at your notes here before I get off track. Back in your notes, the leader who refuses to think about the future soon will not have to worry about the responsibility of leadership. I think that's a fact. And that's from an article that I have over in Appendix C. Because leaders live their lives in the future. You know, they have a foot in the now, but they also have a foot in the future. And by definition, a leader is someone who takes you somewhere you haven't yet been. And so, you know, a leader sort of has this, they sort of know where they're going. Now, they're not astrologers, but they're anticipators. And you know, they're trying to read the signs of the times and saying, how is this going to shake down? Where is this going to go? And I'll try to explain that. 1 Chronicles 12:32. The men of Issachar, the tribe of Issachar, if you're familiar with them, it says, from the tribe of Issachar, there were 200 leaders of the tribe. Now, that's team leadership right there. There are 200 leaders of the tribe with their relatives. Now, the only thing that may be more difficult than leading a church would be trying to lead your relatives, you know. So these guys are serious leaders. But all these men understood the temper of the times, and they knew the best course for Israel to take. Again, they were not astrologers. They were anticipators. And they weren't the kind of people that say things like, I didn't see it coming. Ever anybody say that, you know? I just didn't see it coming. And I think, well, let's put you in charge of the universe, you know, if you didn't see it coming. I mean, you know. But these were not these kind of guys. They saw it. They looked out and they said, "What, you know, what's around the bend? What are the possibilities? What's the potential? Where could we be in this?" And we don't always anticipate because we get caught up in today. But let me give you an example of this real quickly. In some of my growth barriers seminars, part of this church growth thing I do, I talk about the 70% rule. And the 70% rule is about space. And one of the reasons that churches stop growing is because they're out of space, kind of like this room. You know, we're out of space. When you guys came in, it's hard to find a seat in here. So we're up to, you know, 95, 97% capacity in this room right now. But churches, because they're organizations, or organisms rather, not organizations, for some reason it's impossible to put 100% of the people in a room and keep a church growing. So you have to sort of anticipate the future. And when you see your church is growing, when it gets about 70% full, you start thinking about what the next step is going to be. Are we going to start another service? Are we going to multiply, get a bigger space? What are we going to do? Can we bring in more chairs or whatever? But sometimes leaders get caught because they see the growth trend going up, but they'll let it run to 75, 80, 85%, and then their church growth will stall out. And Peter Wagner said at 80%, a church stops growing. All bets are off at 80%. You know, it is going to stop no matter what you do. So I created a 70% rule to buy you the margin between 70 and 80% to figure out the problem. But yet a lot of people miss this. But you've got to read the times. You know, you've got to have some facts. You've got to have some spirit of anticipation. Of course, Peter Drucker said the best way to predict the future is to create it, you know. And so decide what you want to achieve and then work in that direction. But this is what I'm saying. Leaders are not just people of now. They're people of next. And so it's what's going on now and then what's going on next. And we don't anticipate all the time because we get caught up in today. Or let's be really honest, we get caught up in this Sunday. Most of us in this room live and die by Sunday. And, you know, we should. Sunday is game day. Every Sunday is Super Bowl Sunday. It's the biggest day of the week. More people come to Christ than any other day of the week on that day. I mean, it's a big day. But as soon as it's over, there's another one just around the corner. And I don't know if you've noticed or not, but I've noticed in my preaching that Sunday comes around with amazing regularity. And they expect me to have something fresh and new to say the next week. I barely got last week out. And now I got to do next week, you know. And so we get caught up in this Sunday to Sunday cycle. And if we're not careful, we're not going to pastor the same church for 10 years. We're going to pastor the same week for 520 weeks. And so we just get in this routine as to what we're doing. So somehow you've got to break out of that. And part of that is this quote in your notes. We overestimate what we can do in 1 year, and we underestimate what we can do in 5 years. And part of the reason we do that is because we don't even think 5 years. We think 1 week, 2 weeks, a few months, you know. But we've got to think out. So anticipating the future is about asking the right questions. God wired you up so that if you ask Him the right questions and ask the right questions of the world, you're more often than not going to get the answer. So here's some questions for you. The first one, I hope you like it because I made it an underline. The first question is, what happens after what happens next? What happens after what happens next? You see the power of that question? You see, ordinary, average people say, well, what's next? You know, what are we going to do tomorrow? What are we going to do next week? But leaders don't ask what happens next, or only ask what happens next. They say what's going to happen after what happens next. And this is what the men of Issachar did. They understood the temper of the times. They just didn't, you know, they did the long-term forecast, you know. They just didn't get up in the morning and look out and say, it looks like it's going to rain today. That's what's going to happen next. They get up and they look out and they say, this is what's going to happen after what happens next. And this is a tremendous skill, you know. And it's not just thinking about one step out, but it's thinking three, four, five, six steps out. I'll explain that a little bit later. Another question, where do I want to be in 1 year? Just where you are as a leader. What's your 1 year personal growth plan? What do you hope to happen over this next year? Leaders are planners. They lay out the future. They create it, as Drucker says. Where will our church be in 5 years? What's the dream for that? What's the vision for that? What will get me or us there? You know, what's going to get me there where I want to be? What's going to get us there? What will keep me from getting there, you know? What's the limiting factor? You know, the proverbial log jam, you know? Sometimes there's a log jam, all these logs are coming down the river, and there's a jam, and you have to get up in the trees, and you find that one log, and you get it out of the way, and it, It can keep on going. So the future helps you do that. What's going to keep us from getting there as a church? You know, lay that out, even if it's a big deal. I've had to work with church leaders, you know, who knew it was going to take a year or two to get a building program off the ground, or it was going to take a year or two to change a certain structure. But, you know, that's what's keeping you back, and you can predict that and go to work on that and make it happen. And then here's a great question. What should I do to prepare for God's blessing? Or as I say in your notes, for God really blessing me. You see, I think God really wants to bless you. God really wants to bless your church. And somehow or another, He allows us to cooperate with Him in that. You know, occasionally God will bless us in spite of ourselves. But most of the time, God blesses through us. And He chooses to use us as part of that. And that's part of His growth of us, part of His significance that He allows us to happen. So start asking these questions on a regular basis. I'm going to show you in the last skill when you should ask these questions and how you should make these questions a part of your natural routine. I give you a whole article on these three thinking shifts. It's in Appendix C. But let me give you these three thinking shifts for future-focused leaders. So kind of what you have already given for you is sort of what average leaders do. And then I'm going to try to challenge you to be an extraordinary, futuristic leader, if you will. And that's kind of what the fill-ins are about. So here's some shifts. When you go from being an average leader to being an extraordinary leader, you make a shift number one in the area of the future from problem-solving to problem-predicting. You see the difference in that? One of my favorite leadership quotes that's not in your notes is Colin Powell said that 80% of the problems that you face as a leader can be solved by an educated seventh grader. We're paying you for the other 20. Isn't that a great quote? You know, I mean, a lot of what we deal with every day is pretty routine, you know. But I don't want you just to react to problems when they come, but I want you to fix the problems before they happen, you know. And so this is preventative maintenance on a church. This is, you know, having the oil changed at 3,000 miles versus when the engine locks up, you know. It's that kind of problem predicting. Problem solving in our day is just the price of admission. I mean, that's what keeps your job, you know, is solving problems. Problem predicting is the skill of exceptional leadership. It's what moves the ball down the court, you know. How are you going to predict what's happening there? Then shift number two, I take this based off of Luke 14, 28 and 29, where Jesus talked about building the tower. You know, He said, before you build the tower, you should sit down and lay it out, count the costs, make sure you got the plans. Because if you don't, you're going to get halfway through, people are going to come by and they're going to point and they're going to laugh at you. So this is the shift from specific planning to scenario planning. I know it's maybe hard to read the bottom of the board here. S-C-E-N-A-R-I-O, scenario planning. This may be an unfamiliar word for some of you, but the future's not linear. You've probably noticed this, right? You know, Newton had it wrong. The future's not linear. We live in a quantum world, you know. And so, you know, X plus Y does not always equal X plus Y. I mean, that's just, I love equations. Sometimes X plus y equals x plus 1 plus y minus 1. It still is the same if you reduce it down, but it took a different turn to get you there. So the future is like that. You know, you put something in motion, and then two or three possible things could happen. For example, over the next year in your church is either going to grow, it's either going to decline, or it's going to stay the same. Why not have a plan for all of those scenarios? If we grow and God blesses us, here's what we're going to do. If we stall, here's how we're going to examine ourselves and make sure that stall doesn't last too long. If we decline, here's what we're going to do 6 months in so the decline is not as steep. You see what I'm saying? I tell leaders all the time, you know, catch it at the top of the curve. You know, when a church is growing, catch it at the top of the curve and then do something new to keep it growing. Most of us catch our churches at the bottom of the curve, and it's too late. So scenario planning is part of the process. If you love that term and that captures your imagination, there's a book called The Art of the Long View. It's a secular book, if there is such a thing, but it's not specifically written for a Christian audience, I should say, by Peter Schwartz, who invented this whole thing for Exxon. I know they've had their issues, but, you know, big oil companies, they're always wondering, what if the oil reserves run out? What if we strike a new vein? You know, what if the economy changes in the Middle East? And so they're always scenario planning. And this is just good planning for anything that you're doing. So scenario planning is a very powerful tool. And then shift number three, from solitary mind to master mind. From solitary mind to master mind. Mastermind is a term that's been abused in the self-help world, I guess. I'm not down on self-help. I think you get help wherever you can get it, you know. It's interesting that self-help requires you to go buy somebody else's book, not, you know. But anyway, I'm not down on that. I think some pastors could very much benefit from Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, you know. Some pastors could grow their church by 100 if they just learned to smile. Okay, you know, there's some stuff there that you can learn in the self-help world, you know. But this term, unfortunately, has been kind of abused, and it's really been what the original concept of a mastermind was, that if you get multiple minds together in a room, sort of a corporate mind that's bigger than any one mind begins to form. And so out of the individual thinking process, even greater things happen, and this mastermind begins to emerge. Now, I know that sounds really, you know, esoteric for those of us in the spiritual world, but it just goes back to that none of us are as smart as all of us. And it kind of gets to that synergy. You know, you get three minds in a room together, and each mind is at a level 8. Chances are pretty good you're going to get a 30-level idea, you know, because it just takes on more than it would. And so that's what mastermind is. And so our churches are so complicated, we can't just think and figure things out by ourselves. So we have to move from solitary planning to mastermind planning. And again, that goes back to this idea of team leader. Because when you got more eyes on the future, then you're going to have a clearer picture of the future. And so that's what this mastermind thing is. Again, there's a whole article in Appendix C about that. Now, some of you just love this skill. Some of you hated the skill of the future. And that's okay. I'm just trying to push you a little bit. I'm trying to stretch you just a little bit. But I do have some cautions for you, because it is in vogue in our day to be extremely innovative. Our church, the church I pastor, unbeknownst to me, was selected as one of the top whatever innovative churches in America. I don't know, top 20. They did this list, and we were excited about that. We just had nobody to tell, you know. So I'm telling you guys. I mean, you know, like I get up on a Sunday, hey, we're one of the top 20 innovative churches in the nation. They're like, great. What's number one? We'll go there. Innovation's a weird thing, you know. But the thing is, like, I'm not trying to be an innovative church. I'm not trying to be a cool church. I'm trying to be an effective church. And I'll take effective over innovation any day of the week. I'll take clear over cute any day of the week. I'll take clear over cool any day of the week. You know, I want to be a biblical church. You know, now I want to do that in a way that will communicate with the times. But I still talk about all the things. You know, I am fairly famous for a sermon I did one time on hell. You know, I mean, I don't mind dealing with those issues. So sometimes innovative has become like Christianity light or something like that. And there's a whole movement to trying to be on the next wave and the next cutting edge and all that. You know, but sometimes just doing the basic things with excellence is what we're talking about. And so I'm not trying to get you to be the coolest church on the block or whatever. Matter of fact, in your notes, I give you these two cautions. Caution number one, know the difference between the changing and the changeless, you know. And so, you know, change the things that can change, innovate on those things, but don't deviate from the changeless, you know. At the end of the day, we're still coming back to the Bible as our foundation. And then I would challenge you to stay on the leading edge, but not the bleeding edge. You know, and you can be so quick to hold on to the next technology or the next little phrase or whatever that you actually end up, you know, losing ground instead of gaining ground. And Jim Collins, in some of his works like Built to Last and Good to Great, he talks about that. He says most of the great companies, they're not the very first early adopters of technology. They wait for all the bugs to get worked out, and then they adopt it, you know, on the second round or whatever, because they don't have the money to waste on all that stuff. But I've seen a lot of churches get so caught up about, you know, what the future might be, you know, and get into these trends or whatever. So that's not really what I'm talking about with anticipating the future. I'm really talking about reading the signs of the times, being ready for God's blessing in your church. So I hope that makes sense. What I'm going to do is Roy's going to come up and get us ready for a break, but I want to take a couple of questions about the first three skills. Okay, so questions on these first three, or any pressing questions? Yes, sir. Well, it's control, you know. What's the difference between a volunteer team and a staff team? Well, the obvious issue is control. You know, when you sign the paycheck, you have more control over the staff team. But I would actually challenge you to treat a volunteer team like a staff team. And so I actually think that sometimes we stay two hands off, you know, because even though they haven't made a volunteer team hasn't made the commitment with the expectation of reward, you know, in the form of pay or insurance or whatever, they have made the commitment with their time. And so I think sometimes, you know, we have people who understand what high commitment is, but then we treat them with kid gloves. And so I would say with anything, raise the level of expectation on your volunteer teams. And I think you'll actually find more people are attracted and they appreciate that as well. Because if they were going to be on the board of directors for the Performing Arts Center, that's a big job. And they don't get paid, but the expectations are almost the same as they get from their job. So does that sort of get at what you're going? And that's something I had to learn too, because I used to think, oh, they might leave, you know. But I actually find higher commitment keeps them committed, you know, on that. I have a really strong view about church, and that is whatever the average church does. If you'll just do the opposite, you'll probably grow. And so, you know, just be careful about prevailing wisdom. Sometimes, you know, you don't want to be contrarian for contrarian's sake, but sometimes some of the things we've been told is wrong. Yes, sir. Yep. Now we didn't plan this before, did we? I didn't ask you to ask me that question. Okay. Because see, he set me up. He didn't realize this, but hang on for leadership skill number 6. Leadership skill number 6 will answer that question for you. So I'm glad you're thinking that way. You're dead on with where I'm going, and I had hoped to kind of build, you know, and then at the very last minute, you know, had this great release and there's applause and. You know, but probably not. Probably won't happen. Never has happened before. But I'm always hopeful.
I'll see the crowd.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Yes, sir. Yeah, I think we do. Probably not enough. Is that the answer? The question is, how much time do you spend? You know, how much time do I spend with my staff? You can't manage people you can't meet with. And so, you know, I have to be intentional about meeting with my staff. And so I meet with my direct reports, you know, between usually 3 hours on Monday. It's a long meeting, 2 to 3 hours on Monday. Now we may break and go do something and come back together or whatever. But, you know, I have to be able to meet with them. I have to have information. And then, you know, I have to create an atmosphere where they're in constant communication. You know, not that they become dependent on me, but so that we can communicate. And you might ask that question, you know, Jason, he's a direct report to me. Carrick Thomas, who joined us back here, who's my colleague in crime for a lot of these seminars, and we co-wrote some stuff together. He's going to be leading this afternoon. You might ask him just about that as well. But I'm a big fan of, you know, being with your people. And then, you know, you have to also rely on the people. Like in my situation, I have staff, and then they have staff that report to them. So they have to lead them, but I have to also be able to check in on that, you know, weekly or at least every other week or so. But don't be afraid of that. Don't think it's micromanagement. You know, micromanagement is when you're trying to control, not when you're expecting communication. So communication helps you anticipate the future. Control limits potential. Does that help? Okay. Well, let me hand it over to Roy, and he'll tell us about what we're going to do with the break. He'll tell us about what